This episode of Creativity in Captivity is sponsored by the Curtis Theater in Brea, California, presenting Don Reed's The Never Too Late Show on Saturday, May 11th. Tickets are available at the Curtis Theater website. Get ready for insight and inspiration on the creative process from an array of artists, writers, and visionaries on May 9th, when Season 7 of Creativity in Captivity kicks off. In the meantime, please enjoy over 150 episodes hosted by Pat Hazel with a stable of creative guests in our listening lounge at creativityincaptivity.fun.
This is Creativity in Captivity, and I'm Pat Hazel, and today I have the pleasure of talking to an unparalleled trombone player, a groundbreaking songwriter that elevates contemporary jazz to new heights. She has collaborated with Postmodern Jukebox and Dave Koz and knows how to command the stage from clubs to festivals. Joining me now, vocal gymnast and musical lightning rod on the trombone, Aubrey Logan.
That spark of electricity, a skipping stone that sets you free, you're captive to a mystery, the curse of creativity. La 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 la. La la la.
What's up, Pat? I'm happy to be here.
So were you singing before you picked up the trombone, or had you been playing trombone for some period of time and singing happened in parallel to that?
The singing came first. I was raised in Seattle area by two music educators, and they had vast taste in music. So they were always playing the Carpenters and Samuel Barber and Blood, Sweat, and Tears in Chicago and Ella Fitzgerald and Stevie Wonder and Beethoven within the span of an hour. And I just thought that was normal. And I didn't have an instrument. I had a little bit of remedial piano lessons. I didn't have an instrument in my hand, really, so I sang all the time, and I emulated what I was hearing. All you do is mimic when you're a child, because children probably don't have the life experience to really sing about a breakup.
Right, the emotional resonance isn't there.
Not really. So I would listen to Whitney Houston sing I Will Always Love You, and I apparently did my best impression of her. I guess it was pretty good. And I didn't have any other interests except singing the same way I was hearing all these other singers sing throughout the speakers that my parents were playing. So whether it was Dolly Parton or Karen Carpenter, I'm going to try and do it like they do it. And Michael Jackson, like, just as much as I could do. And so I was singing first, and I loved it so much. And I would put on shows for my family. I would sing at church all the time. And we didn't live in Nashville, where you just took your kid up to get a record deal. And we didn't live in LA, where you brought them to auditions. And we didn't live in New York, where my parents were bringing me to jam sessions till 2 a.m. We lived in Seattle, which was a lovely place to grow up, with the nature and the mountains and everything nearby. But what was going on in the arts, besides my parents' public school music programs that they were running, was musical theater. So they took me to auditions for that. I have to show off my voice in front of people on a stage. Sign me up. That was the kind of kid I was. So I did get a start singing and dancing and acting. The first one was my strength. The second two, still working on those. But the musical theater experience at such a young age taught me how to work, taught me how to memorize, block, communicate to an audience. I mean, there's no way you're going up there and you're not allowed to have a sad look on your face. You're supposed to put on a show. And so I learned how to put on a show with the pressure. I don't think it was bad pressure. It was good pressure. My parents were cool. There were some parents I met that I would go home with my mom and go, "Mommy, thank you for not being like those weird stage moms." But that was my background. And then my dad brought home a bunch of instruments for me to play when I was like 12 years old to try so I could play it in the band.
To try to determine what one you might be most suited for?
Yeah, he was a trumpet player. And my mom was the choir director at my school, so there was no way I was going to be in choir. So she went up to her colleague, the band director. My dad wasn't the band director at my school. He was a principal at another school at the time, but he was an experienced music teacher and jazz trumpet player. And he brought home a few instruments from his school because the band director looked at my mom and said, "Well, sure, she can join band. What does she play?" And I didn't. I could read music because of the musical theater requirement. It was required, and I could play enough piano to get by, but I didn't play a wind instrument, and I was late. All the kids started a couple years prior to me.
What age do you think you are at that point?
12.
Okay.
And I'm back in normal school. I'm aging out of some child roles. I'm back in middle school. Wanted to be with my friends. I picked trombone because my parents, they played James Brown in Chicago all the time. I knew what a trombone was. I knew what it sounded like. I wanted to be in the jazz band, so I didn't want to play flute. I now know jazz flute's great, but I didn't know that at the time. And I could make a sound on the trombone. So I started playing the trombone. I already was singing. When I started playing trombone, it was a lot less musical theater and a lot more jazz. So I realized, oh, these singers like Ella Fitzgerald are singing the same songs that I learned in these musical theater productions, except she's singing it the way she wants to. So that was the difference. Oh, and I can play it like that too. So then it just started to merge. Folk, pop, jazz, R&B songwriting came about just from hearing Carole King all the time. It all is a big soup.
Yeah, but it's interesting that the trombone becomes the choice in that you have to have a specific kind of ability and different instruments. I only learned it because my kids tried out for band, and we went to the day where they tried all the different ones, and they said, oh, no, his lips are more suited for the French horn because of this. And I didn't know the first thing about any of it, but I did have a trombone player and I had a French horn player that were both very good that came out of my house. But one of the things that fascinates me about the trombone is it replaces the vocals in the arrangement. We can almost hear the words through the trombone. Like when you stop singing and you play a section with the trombone, I still hear the lyric. It is your ability to communicate emotionally and musically through that instrument. I was Googling some things like, what does the trombone represent? And do you know what it represents? They said it symbolizes God or a supernatural phenomenon.
I knew it was God's chosen instrument. I knew it. Thank you for clarifying that for me.
Well, that's what, I mean, again, Google, anybody could have put it into Google. I just happened to extract it.
Well, I know it's a German instrument. It used to be called the sackbut. And anything with the word butt in it sounds fun to me. I didn't even learn that until after. So that was just the icing on the cake.
Did people make fun of you carrying a trombone to and from school? Like, was that a awkward instrument for a girl to take to school?
At the time, no. I mean, I came up in the 2000s and everything was fine. Everything was hunky-dory, other than it was a little bit cumbersome, and still is, if I'm honest, to carry around and put on the plane all the time. I was made fun of for so many reasons other than the trombone. That was the least of my worries.
The trombone was the least of your problems.
The trombone was the least of my worries. There were a lot of girls in the band. I've had many challenges in my life, but that wasn't one of them.
Oh, that's interesting. Frank Sinatra said that the greatest teacher that he had wasn't a vocal coach, but the way that Tommy Dorsey breathed and phrased on the trombone.
I have heard that, and that makes a lot of sense. And Tommy Dorsey really did sing through the instrument. It's hard to find a trombone player who doesn't at least know how to sing. They might not do it on the mic. Like, I know how to play piano, and I'm not really confident enough to do it on stage. I write with it. I write with a piano. But same with these trombone players. They all kind of know how to sing. It's sort of difficult to play the trombone without at least being able to sing because we don't have buttons to push. We are using a big tuning slide the whole time and we have to use our ears to adjust the pitch. And if we don't, we're going to be out of tune. So there's some sort of connection there. Also, as far as playing the trombone is concerned, in the middle of a song, I'll sing a verse and then pick up a trombone and play an improvised solo, it's still the same brain behind the microphone as it is behind the trombone. And I'm not doing anything new. Louis Armstrong did it long before me. And Frank Rosalino did it long before me. Singing and playing a brass instrument or singing and even playing a saxophone is not really a new art. It just looks weird to the modern eye to see a chick sing and then pick up a big brass instrument that's 2/3 my size and play it in a not black and white film. But I'm not doing anything really that new as far as that's concerned. It's a jazz tradition to sing and play your instrument and improvise on your horn. It's like when I scat sing, all that is improvising with my voice instead of with my trombone and when you say Frank Sinatra learned from Tommy Dorsey, I learned more of my phrasing from not even trombone players and not even singers. It's just, we've all got the same 12 notes. Dexter Gordon, the saxophone player, was my biggest influence as far as phrasing, whether I'm singing jazz or playing trombone. And then when it comes to pop and rock and roll, R&B stuff, there's a bunch of different influences that I've had, but they've all got the same 12 notes too. They're just treating them differently.
When did you begin to collaborate with Postmodern Jukebox? I love the way they do the stuff, the arrangements they make, but it's such dynamic ensemble to be with. And when you're featured in those songs, it's so much fun. It's just infused with some certain contagiousness that you can go down a rabbit hole watching those tunes. But when did you get started with them?
I moved to LA in 2012. And I was starting to make my own YouTube channel of covers. Nobody wants to hear your original song if they don't know who you are. I was covering Bruno Mars and Michael Jackson and Pitbull and doing them in my way, which was jazzier than theirs. That was sort of the point. I just wasn't doing it as period, as on the nose 1920s as Scott Bradley was doing with Postmodern Jukebox. And I started posting my videos and making friends in LA, making friends on the scene. And I started to see Scott Bradley's videos just go incredibly viral. And he was really taking like a Katy Perry song and making it sound like it was from the 1920s. Very, very specific, which was different than me, but still kind of the same. And I got a phone call one day from Scott. And he said, oh, I got your number from so-and-so, from so-and-so, from so-and-so. You want to come do a video with us? And I was like, well, yeah, of course. And I thought to myself, Scott just went totally viral. I better make this count. So I wrote an entire vocalese to the Kendrick Lamar rap with Taylor Swift on the song Bad Blood. And I gave it to Scott. I said, here, I wrote a bass line, I wrote the melody, and I wrote basically the form. You write the other instrumentation the way you want. And he arranged the rest of it. The cool thing about Postmodern Jukebox videos is they do it all in one take. And it's the rule. And I do that too now with most of my jazz records if they're not very poppy, because that's just what you do. But what Scott has done, and I think people want it, is from start to finish, Postmodern Jukebox videos are live and they're doing songs that are EDM now and they're not live. And people love it. And it's proving to me that people still want to hear real human beings play real instruments and sing real songs and just sing. And not be auto-tuned and not be overdubbed. That's exciting to the human ear. They might not know it anymore because they're not used to hearing it. But then when they hear it, I think they want it.
Yeah, they do want it. And I don't think they even know why, though. But there is something that comes through that video that gives you a sense that you're at the GarageBand moment when it's happening.
It's human. It's why they still do like Ella Fitzgerald and they don't know why. It's why they do like hearing Linda Ronstadt sing Blue Bayou and they don't know why. And, oh, it sounds vintage and old and awesome, but it's just, they're just singing.
Yeah. And when you sit down yourself to write, how's your brain going when you pick up a cover? I know that you have an album called Standards and you're not playing them as written. You're doing your own arrangements of them.
That's nothing but fun.
I know. I'm sure it's great fun because you already know the tune itself has a certain amount of brand recognition. But you're changing that in times where we have to come to rediscover the song, aren't we?
Yes. But I'm also just drawing from my own childhood and what I was exposed to growing up and what earworms I found to be earworms. So my standard album is 100% self-indulgent. And I arranged it all while the world was all shut down. So I definitely did that for myself. But I also thought people might like it because you get to a point as an artist where if you try too hard to appease your audience, you may not find that sustainable in the long run. And then you're stuck being somebody you're not in front of people for however many more decades you have left in your industry. So Standard was just pure fun. I hadn't made an album of covers or standards yet, which is weird. I'm like a jazz singer without a jazz album. That's kind of funny.
But some of your original work, I was listening to cuts off of The Sunshine is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all originals, right?
For the most part.
Yeah.
Save for like two or three. Yeah.
That particular LA song, it's very revealing. There's an awful lot about the time that you were in LA. It feels like it is. It feels like you're saying, hey, talk is cheap. Sunshine's expensive. I'm going to stay here for now. I'm going to play the game. But you don't live there now. So you wrote it after you left LA, this song.
No, I wrote it while I was there.
So tell me the frame of mind you were writing, because I feel it when you're singing that song. I really feel it.
Yeah, I was sad and depressed about living in LA when I wrote the song about being sad and depressed living in LA. I don't like to be sad and depressed. I don't prefer it. So I make fun of it a little bit and then I feel a little better. And that's what the song is about. I ran into so many people all the time, actors auditioning constantly, old friends from my college just grinding, feeling like they couldn't get ahead in LA. Hollywood looks so glamorous and perfect and flawless and fun and sunny, but you get there and it kind of chews you up and spits you out. It's kind of just the city of rejection. It's a facade. And that's the point. That the funny part about it is that's actually the point. You're actually making entertainment there to fool people. On purpose. So it started to get, so I would hear people say this, hear my friends say these things to me. Oh, I'm sick of being here, but I got to be here and I got to look shiny and I don't feel shiny. Writing LA was a bit of writing what everybody was already thinking.
Yeah. You have a lyric. Can you believe I'm still here? I really like the one where you said my career is moving at the same pace as the I-5 North.
Yes. Right?
If anybody lived there, I used to have a joke about go south on the 5. People would always say, where are you going? Oh, you're going to San Diego. Okay, you go south on the 5. To me, go south on the 5 sounded like go straight to hell. Take your stupid ideas and go south on the 5, Bob.
So true.
In LA itself, there's cool things. There's cool people. You can find a lot of things. And it's certainly loaded with sunshine, as you mentioned. But
the weather's perfect.
It's perfect. There were neighbors I don't think I met until there was an earthquake and it was 5 in the morning and they came out in their bathrobes and they lived next to me for 3 or 4 years. Other parts of the country, you do other things besides focus on the business. And there it seemed like everybody, the dry cleaner has pictures of all these old has-been celebrities. You're thinking, what do I care if Beretta got his shirt dry cleaned here? Why is that your resume now? It's really funny how that association with entertainment falls into the barbershop and it falls into the deli. And
well, because everybody working at Starbucks is also auditioning for TV shows.
Or they're sitting there writing a screenplay with their coffee. They want to be seen writing a screenplay so people know they're a screenwriter.
That is indeed the point of going to Starbucks in LA.
Right. So do you like the life balance of living in Texas at this point?
I do. I like the life balance. Here's what happened. I got to LA and naturally did what one does in LA, sang on TV shows, did voiceovers, played in sessions, SAG-AFTRA as much as I could. The point was to have my own band and do my own tours. And as that continued, the ratio of being home versus being on the road started to flip. And I was on the road so much that I was not even getting called anymore to do voiceovers or work in LA because everybody's like, well, she's not here. Oh, look at her Instagram. She's not even around. Oh, she probably won't be around. And that's okay. All of that's okay. So I was on this tour with Dave Cause and we were all sitting at dinner and I was looking around the table at the whole band and I'm like, he lives in DC. He lives in LA. He lives in Texas. He lives in New York. We were doing a show in Austin and I was enjoying myself here so much that I went, oh, I should move here. Ha ha ha. That's funny. But then I kept looking around going, I really like it here. I want to be here. Then I looked at the table at dinner before the show and realized everybody in the band lived somewhere else. And I was like, I don't have to live in LA. It just dawned on me. It just dawned on me. There are really good reasons to live in LA. I shouldn't have one anymore because I'm going to keep doing this forever. I'm going to keep going on tour. It would be nice to live in a town with a thriving music scene. It would be good for my soul. It's good for my creativity. I need that. I need to be able to have a hometown band. Austin has all that. Some of the best jazz musicians I've ever heard are in this town. They were all on the Standard album and they were all on my Christmas album that I just put out. and they're world class, and I need an airport, and that's about it. So here we are. And then I moved to Austin, and then I had a baby. Isn't that sort of the order of operations? Not the other way around.
No, but it is nice once you find a life balance that you also realize you don't have to spend half your day in traffic to get to and from a meeting, that your writing time and the other things that you do don't require you to go places. It's become more evident to everyone now that you can have a meeting on Zoom that your time has value. But when you're dealing with raising a family and you're still chasing a muse, then the balance is that becomes a priority too. I don't know how many times in LA when I was there, they would have a general meeting with the network or something. And I go, what does that mean? Like,
what's actually on the agenda?
Yeah, there's nothing on the agenda. We're going to introduce you and they're going to ask you to read something. When I very first started, and this is very naive, you think they want to see if you can read the material. They don't care about the material. They only care about the presence. Can this person bring something to the party that we can exploit? And I mean that in a complimentary way,
sure.
Which is they don't want somebody that can do stuff that all the other people are already doing. They have all those people.
I don't look upon that time with disdain. It was a time. It was a season. And it helped me. I can't imagine having the opportunities I have now without having sown seeds there and met the people I met there, even though some of these opportunities have nothing to do with LA, but I probably wouldn't be playing the Detroit Symphony in December if I didn't live in LA and meet the people there. One thing leads to another type of web of—
Oh, no, absolutely. Here's the thing. Foundationally, I would say whatever art a person's in, if it's music, if it's comedy, if it's writing, in the earliest stages, your Algonquin Roundtable or your place that you jam with people, those people are going to rise at the same rate that you do. And they're likely to be at the epicenter of the entertainment business in New York or in LA or in Chicago. But once you graduate from that and you get your merit badge, you move from being in a town where it's very centric about you have to be here to win. I took the attitude when I moved to Mandeville, Louisiana, which was a little town, was I'm just making a bigger playing field. I'm just making it America. My material is very much Americana stand-up, so I knew I wasn't going to be playing in Europe with my jokes. They're not going to get references to pop rocks. But I literally opened my mind to say, well, now America's my hometown. Why do I care? As long as I can get to their performing arts center, they don't care where I live, not one bit. Can I get to there by showtime and have a nice show with a good tech writer and bring that audience in and sell tickets? And that became the way I approached it, was to make my brand more accessible to the Performing Arts Center to be able to invite their audience to come to it.
I like that. That's exactly how I feel.
When I talk to people who are starting in this business or want to put a show on, I always say, you're not just trying to get hired. You don't want to just get the paycheck and never go back to that venue. You want to be the partner that shows them how the ticket sales through your database and your video and your radio ad, how does that invite a person to unearth $30 or $40 from their pocket and go spend the night with you?
Right. You want them to never be able to live without you. You want them to look forward to your next show for the rest of their lives.
It's exciting when you can be a transformative performer. And I think I consider you to be this, where once people see you interpret a song, you're such a dynamic singer and you have a multi-talent with the trombone and all of that, that they don't forget you. You become in a different category. They didn't see a singer last night. They saw Aubrey Logan.
I do. That's really nice.
It's very, very important as you pick songs for your album that you're always protecting
that. It is. And that's why I get really precious about the songs I pick for my album. That's why I'm not hired to be somebody else's singer ever. That's why I had a very short-lived wedding singer career and by the way, I also don't look upon that with disdain because that taught me how to memorize. That taught me how to memorize out at the wazoo, and that was how I kind of paid my rent in college in Boston.
With a well-memorized wazoo?
I still had MapQuest, and I drove myself around to fancy New England weddings and sang in this wedding band, and it was so hard. It was so hard, and the sound was never good, and everything was always working against you, and they wanted you to sing I Will Always Love You. And you're like, dude, it's a breakup song. Why am I singing this at your wedding? They didn't realize. And I'm kind of going, did you listen to the words or just hear the nice big belting? But it's why I don't get singer for hire really ever, because I am too focused on doing the music that I have to love. I love good songwriters. I think they are some of the best minds in the world. I think John Mayer is one of the best songwriters I've ever heard. But I'll get opportunities to co-write, and it's very rare that I find a good match. So I just write on my own. Or can you sing the song I wrote? And I hear it. And it's not that it's even bad, but it's that I don't resonate with the lyrics. Something about it doesn't feel like it makes sense. I can't fake this one. I'll sing songs all day that have nothing to do with my life. I'll sing torch songs, Broadway torch songs. I've never had that kind of breakup. I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm okay playing that role. I'm not okay playing every role. I'm just not.
Right. That's interesting. Well, the song that you have, the Louboutins 2.0, I know it's a great song though, because
that's another make fun of LA song.
You are totally revealing what you think about the conforming to expectations and the idea that they may be expensive and maybe you think they're hot, but I can't dance in these shoes for anything. I want to get these things off.
This is not me. This doesn't feel like me.
That's why that song is so good for you, is that it's a confessional song. I tried.
I did.
Let me just dance barefoot for three tunes here. I'll be happy. I'll carry these home over my shoulder, and then we'll get an In-N-Out burger. It's kind of a male-imposed sense of sexuality, that the sense of those shoes. Yeah.
Because the Christian Louboutin came up with the shoes, and he's a man. Is that what you mean?
Interesting.
They are pretty. They're very pretty. And there are some women that it just does make sense. It does. Just not me. I remember, too, I wrote that song after a stylist helped me clean out my wardrobe. He gave me some really good pointers. One of them I will never, ever forget. And he's like, you have to wear bolder colors. It needs to be very black or very white. No middle muted colors for you. It doesn't work. It's not working. And then he had to show me. He had to prove it to me that this is the case. And he was right. He was right. And he's always been right. The decade that has gone by since then, that is still true.
Well, I would imagine that some of those bold colors and the strong black and white are as dynamic as you are.
That's probably where he was going with it. Yeah. I've got like kind of dark hair and fair skin. And he's like, you just have to kind of go with that. Make your clothes match that.
But LA is putting on a show, and I don't put it down either, because I do, as a kid, I watched a lot of television. I got the calling.
Yes. So
what's funny about the stage or theater, which is where I found out what I really like, is that part, even more than television or movies or that kind of exposure. That to me is storytelling. Some people have to be near an ocean, that there's something about there, it literally is spiritual, or somebody has to live in the mountains and see the snow or they can't survive. And what's interesting to me is whenever I'm in a theatrical environment, if I go to see a show or if I go to a movie and it's not started yet, and I look at all these people facing forward and I go, there should be a show going out. Something should be happening right there. People gathering is what I'm most attracted to. And changing them from a workaday life to giving them the gift of experiencing humanity is one thing. And there is something that changes about us when we laugh as a community, when we cry, when we applaud. Nobody says, do it now. It just begins to happen because we all start to have a feeling or an emotion or a celebration. And I really think that's a powerful thing as an entertainer to experience. And so, you know, you do it song after song and night after night, but it fuels you, doesn't it?
It does. I don't really know the point of the music without it. And it does fuel me. It does. I think just you were made to make people laugh and think. And I think I was made to sing songs with some jest and with some truth and with some fun. I think if we're not doing what we were created to do, we get in trouble. I think we might waste our time with things we shouldn't be doing.
I think that's a nice little lesson.
Yeah.
I think what's a shame sometimes is when you see other people, talented people, and they never connect to the train that's going to where their destination needs to be. Maybe they don't explore or say yes to something, or because of the fear of risk. They want a little stability.
I'm guilty of it.
Yeah. At times. Are you that way now?
Anymore. I think I just know if I want it and if I see it, and if I know if I don't want it, if an opportunity comes my way. And yeah, but no anymore.
Right. I think that there's a risk to reward factor here. Once you have a skill set, and that includes what you do talent-wise, but also what your instinct is about an experience or an industry or a festival, you go, oh, okay, I can walk a tightrope. So it doesn't really matter if it's 2 feet off the ground or 2,000 feet off the ground.
Right. Yes. Where did you come up with that analogy? Can I steal that?
You may steal it.
Can I put it in a song?
Yes, please.
I can walk a tightrope. It doesn't matter if it's 2 feet off the ground or 100 feet off the ground.
There you go. You know what? I love the tone of your voice while you're thinking it, because what we're hearing is a songwriter writing a song.
Well, lately I'm in a bit of a songwriting slump. Well, I'm not though, because the other day I wrote like 3 songs in a day, which hasn't happened in years.
If that's a slump for you, that's pretty good.
They're not perfect, but they at least exist. And that's the risk you take. You risk writing a bad song when you start writing a song.
Are you familiar with Leonard Bernstein saying he gets up early and writes 3 songs to get the bad songs out of the way? And that's all part of it. It's not like they're terrible. It's just sort of the warm up.
Yes. And he said a lot of good things. And I have a running list of prompts now. So that just went on my list of prompts. I have a running list of just interesting things I'm hearing people say in elevators, or just things I heard somebody say on the radio that's weird, or stuff I see on the news that's odd. Just weird words.
In comedy, we do the same thing.
Okay.
Overhearing things often makes you tell the rest of the story that you didn't know. I overheard somebody say, it takes more than 2 beers to get me naked dancing on a picnic table. And this was behind me at an airport. And I thought to myself, well, I have to look. I have to see if the person is worth sending the 2 beers to.
Of course. See, now I'm laughing.
Well, you start to make a picture of, that's the weirdest thing I've heard today. There's many jokes in my act that are no more than stories, overheard stories. And I do think human beings need story. Once you have food and shelter and clothing and water, it's all story. Everything the rest of your life is story, because it's what the newspaper and what the television and what you're watching on Instagram, you're just looking for stories. And it used to be much more that stories actually saved our lives. Don't eat those mushrooms on the trail. You would pass these stories on as survival skills. Well, we've way past picking berries and ourselves and laying rail. And so now stories are combined efforts of entertainment. You collect stories so that when you're at the next party or dinner table, you go, oh, I heard this thing. Like, everyone is living in this search to hear and tell stories.
They are. And that's fodder for us creatives, isn't it?
It is.
It's like, hand it to me on a silver platter, why don't you?
They don't know when they hear a song from you that it's not just your interpretation of what happened to you. Their mind emotionally is piecing themselves into, why does a person re-sing that song in the car over and over?
Because they relate.
Right. There's an identity of some kind. And the better songwriter you are, the more you're touching something that is so personal that it becomes universal.
Better comedian you are, same thing. People laugh at what they know.
Well, I see that you are featured in April coming up at the Miller Center for the Arts for something called The Future Is Now. Is that a jazz festival, or what does that banner mean?
There's a few young artists on that show, and that's probably why they call it that. Ilya Serov is one, and a few others that are friends of mine. It's the easiest gig ever. I play 3 of my songs, and then I back them up on theirs. It's at the Berks Jazz Festival. It's near Philadelphia.
Is it fun to reconnect with friends and be able to just go into a jam, just a crazy reunion?
It's so much fun. It's fun because we all used to be so scared, and now we're okay, and we all survived. And we just kind of look at each other like, we survived it. We did it. We're okay. You know? And here we are. That's sort of the stage of life I feel like I'm in. It's like the, I kind of went through that hellish, very young, very green, say yes to everything, but not always in a good way sort of time of life, which you all kind of have to do in this business. Yeah, you just kind of have to jump in the water and sink or swim a little bit for a time. And those of the people I see now, I guess they kept swimming. And now we're having way more fun because we're writing the stuff we really want to write and we're having fun with the audience.
Well, you cover a lot of different styles, jazz and funk and fusion and calypso. And so I was thinking, wow, is there a favorite? Jazz, I know, is your DNA at this point.
That means a lot of things. I'm also cheating by using that term. It means I can do whatever I want. Because when you say the word jazz, people can think Spyro Gyra, or people can think Annie Ross, or people can think Dave Koz or Anita Baker. So it's a cheat for me. It means I can play any kind of music I want. John Mayer headlined a jazz festival recently. Prince headlined the Montreux Jazz Festival before he died. So I kind of cheat and use that term because it's a historic term that spans almost two centuries now.
So now we just think Aubrey Logan and all that jazz.
I'm about to collaborate with a country singer. And the thing is, country music also came from like the southeast part of our country, just like jazz did. Blues, jazz, tensions and notes, storytelling. It's all the same stuff. People asked Charlie Parker, why do you listen to so much country music? And he says, guess what his answer was? It's the stories. So I think the same person who can play very cerebral bebop scales, which is fun for someone like me who's educated in it, I know full well my audience doesn't necessarily know what's going on. So I have to tell some stories. Or I'm just going to be at the academic shows. I want to appeal to the academics because I kind of am one. A little bit.
You also don't want to do that because you are such a inherently such an entertaining person. I'm not saying that academia can't have an entertainment factor to it, but the bottom line is it's not really about hitting the notes.
No, although I do go to a lot of schools now and talk to a lot of young people, but I'm happy to do that and not be on staff at the university.
As a guest, what do you tell a young person that wants music to be a center of their universe?
They need to utilize what they have available to them now that I didn't necessarily have available to me before 2007. And that is, they can be as themselves musically as they want to be and put it on the internet and see who bites. That is how I have a career. I just didn't have it till later. And I didn't know how it worked. And it's a little bit of a daunting task, but I also see it as quite an opportunity because you don't have to be the most famous person in the world. You can still find your million people who love you, your 100,000 people who are devoted to you, your 500 people who will follow you and love whatever you play for the rest of your life, will give you a career forever. I just tell young people, take advantage of that and keep learning your scales and arpeggios because you don't want to go up on stage and not know what you're going to play and not have confidence behind your instrument. You still have to work at it, but it's an interesting time to make music.
Well, you have a number of albums. They can find out about those albums at aubreylogan.com. And I saw some great stuff on YouTube, which is Aubrey Logan Music. And also, I heard a lot of cool stuff on Spotify. So there's a lot of ways to find you.
Everywhere that you listen to music.
Whatever allows people to discover you, I encourage it. We're happy to amplify your voice here. I can't wait to see you in Austin at the Parker Jazz Club one of these days.
I would love that.
Cool. Well, it's fun to have you in the sandbox. So thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's close things out with Aubrey Logan's song Laundry featuring Dave Koz.
Some girls like it when you sweet talk them. Some want you to call them on the phone. But I don't need no sentiment or nothing. I'm happy chilling with you because you know just how to leave me alone. Some girls want all that fancy jewelry. But I could pick that out all by myself. If there's one thing that turns me on, gets me out of bed in the morning and right back in at night, it's when you wash and fold the colors and the
Thanks for listening. Take a moment to subscribe and we will hold your seat for more creative conversation and a weekly spark of inspiration. Our show is produced by Sweetwood Creative in Austin, Texas, with sound editing and crafty co-producing by Tucker Hazel. The original music theme was created and sung by Maya Sharp, with additional production support and sanity provided by Diane Johansson, Tony Deo, and Tanner Dykstra. Please feel free to dash off a review on social media to help grow this creative community. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, or visit our website at creativityincaptivity.fun. You heard that right, .fun, as in dot was so fun. Bye for now.